Hey, welcome to the Meta Church Podcast. We're thankful that you're taking part of your day to spend it with us, and we pray this message encourages you, inspires you, and leads you to experience the transformative power of Jesus in your life.
Okay, well, what's up? We are starting a brand new series today called The Lead Up. But man, before I even jump into this, it is hard to believe that we are just 3 weeks away from Easter Sunday. Like 3 weeks from today will be Easter Sunday, the biggest celebration, the biggest holiday in the Christian faith, in the Christian tradition is happening. And it's only 3 weeks away. It's like every year it happens, but every year just exciting. And I've got to tell you, like, I love Easter. And I think that's kind of like a prerequisite if you're going to be a pastor. Like, you ought to love Easter because it's about Jesus. It's the biggest day of your faith. It's the biggest day of your belief system. Like, it probably ought to matter a little bit. I genuinely love Easter. I love the hope that it provides, that no matter the circumstance you find yourself in, God is not finished. God is not done. I love the purpose that it brings, that despite, you know, grief and loss and death, meaning and hope and purpose can be found. And I love the life that it offers, that those of us who believe in Jesus Christ are reminded that through the power of his resurrection, we have life eternal with God forever. I love it. Like, I love Easter. You know what I love about this year's Easter? I love that this year I get to celebrate with other people. After the past 2 years, man, like, you know, Easter 2020, Easter 2021, like, all I've done is, like, I've preached to a camera a few days in advance. I shut it off. I sent off the stuff to be edited or whatever. And then Easter Sunday, I'm sitting on my couch. I watch it on YouTube, turn off the TV, and that, like, that's it. Like, it's been miserable. I honestly, like, Easter 2020 was probably, like, one of my lowest parts or lowest experiences, like, in ministry. It's like I turn off the TV, shut off the laptop, and it was, like, so foreign to be, like, this is the biggest day of the year, and I don't even get to see my friends. I don't get to see the people who love Jesus. I don't get to celebrate with them. I don't get to worship with them. Like, it was just so bizarre. But this year, it's different. Like, I'm still going to be preaching to a camera, but at least I get to watch with other people. I get to celebrate with other people. I get to worship with other people. We get to laugh. We get to rejoice. We get to, you know, be a part of each other's lives. And so I'm super, super excited about this year's Easter. But you know what I don't love about Easter? What I find, like, maybe a little bit frustrating or a little discouraging about Easter? It's how temporary or how momentary Easter can feel. How it's like we build up to this one Sunday and then it comes and it happens and then it's gone and it's kind of on to the next thing. Like, you know, if you're my daughter, you're like, what are we having for lunch? You know, like, what are we doing for Easter brunch? You know, oh, shoot, I got this thing coming up this week for work, so I've got to do that. Or I've got spring break with my kids, so I've got a, you know, vacation that I'm taking or whatever. And it just kind of like it happens and then boom, like poof, it's gone. And as a pastor, I find this to be incredibly discouraging, right? Because for months we're praying into what are we going to preach? You know, there's preparation for our services. And you know, if you have like a venue or a building, like there's all this stuff like volunteers and all these things you got to do to get right. And you do all this buildup and you celebrate on this one day. But then the fruit of that feels like it's minuscule, like the lasting impact throughout the course of the year is a little none. Like, sure, people get saved, so that's eternal, right? Like, I'm not minimizing that. There are people who meet Jesus. There are people who give their lives to Christ on Easter Sunday all over the world, and that is significant, and that alone is worth it. But when you talk about the day-in, day-out implications of Easter, it feels like there's little to none beyond the Easter celebration. You know what it's like? It's kind of like an anniversary. Like, this summer, Chris and I, on August 5th, will be celebrating 15 years of marriage. Our 15th wedding anniversary. Like, that's crazy. We were babies. Like, we were such little kids. But 15 years of marriage this summer. And you know what it would be like is, like, that anniversary day, August 5th, it happens every year. And every year, it's like, this is the best day of our marriage. This is the best day of our lives. And we celebrate it and we go all out and we make it a big deal. But then the other 364, it's kind of like our marriage is ho-hum. Like, it's okay, whatever, fine. We talk to each other. We see each other. But we don't really think about, like, what we mean to one another. We don't think about how being together or being connected together changes who we are and changes how we live. And sometimes Easter can feel like that. Sometimes, like, the Easter celebration can feel that way, where it's like this big day and it's annual and it's every year. We know it's coming and we celebrate and we make it a huge deal. But then how it plays out in our everyday lives, the other 364 days of the year, it has little bearing or has little impact. But this year, this year, Krista and I are on a mission to change that. We at Meta are on a mission to change that. And I know that's loud, and I know that's audacious and maybe a bit ambitious, but our goal this year is to not let the Easter story, not let the Easter experience be like a one-time event or a one-time occurrence, and rather we want to make it into a lifestyle. Like if Easter was a brand, okay? Like if Easter was a brand, our goal and our desire is that it is a lifestyle brand, a brand that you want to wear, a brand that you want to put on, a brand that you see yourself a part of, a brand that incorporates itself into the fabric of your everyday lives and your everyday being. We don't want Easter to be like a one-time event or a one-time service or a one-time product, if you will. We want it to be a lifestyle, something that has significance and sway over what happens in your life each and every day, because that's what Easter should. It should be something, a way of living and engaging your relationship with Jesus. And as I said, I know that's an ambitious goal, but that is precisely the goal of this brand new series that we begin today called The Lead Up. That is the goal of this series, is to help us see Easter as a year-round part of our lives, not just a one-time occurrence. And during this series, what we're going to do is look at the events, some key events that took place in Jesus' life as he led up to the cross, as he was leading his way to Jerusalem, as he was leading the way to the cross. There were some key events, some key moments in Jesus' life that are a part of the Easter story. And although the crucifixion and the resurrection happened over the course of a weekend, what we'll see and what we'll discover is that the events leading up to the cross actually occurred over a period of several months. And that's where we're going to begin. And there's several parts to this. There are several parts to this Easter story that I believe are essential or necessary to embody or to embrace if we want the Easter story to have more than just kind of a once a year impact on our lives. And I don't know that I've ever done this. It's not really like a big deal. But here's how we're going to break it down, because for today and the following 3 weeks, there are four parts that we want to reveal and share to you and help apply to your everyday life. And now I'll put them up on the screen for you, because the lead up to Easter entails four parts. First, there's invitation. That's what we're going to talk about today. Then there's preparation, then expectation, and then activation. The Easter story involves or entails these four parts, these four components. And it's not just the Easter event that entails this, but it's how these things are lived out in our lives. And as we'll discover, these parts are not just a part of a story, but they have the potential to be a part of our lives to transform who we are and how we walk with Jesus each and every day. And the reality is that these four things can keep the Easter story fresh, relevant, alive, and active in our lives every day of the year. So with all that as the background, and with all that as the setup, the lead up to the lead up, if you will, I want to begin somewhere around 8 to 9 months before Jesus' crucifixion. And to get there, we'll need to start in Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. I'm reading out of the New Living Translation, and here's what it says. We'll read the first 9 verses. It says, 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain to be alone. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed so that his face shone like the sun and his clothes became as white as light. Suddenly, Moses and Elijah appeared and began talking with Jesus. And Peter exclaimed, Lord, it's wonderful for us to be here. If you want, I'll make 3 shelters as memorials, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. I love Peter. He's so helpful. Verse 5, but even as he spoke, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my dearly loved son who brings me great joy. Listen to him. The disciples were terrified, and they fell face down on the ground. Then Jesus came over and touched them. Get up, he said, don't be afraid. And when they looked up, Moses and Elijah were gone. Notice this last phrase. And they saw only Jesus. Verse 9. As they went back down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Now, I want to give you kind of a little bit of context for what's occurring here in Matthew 17. This is what's known as the Transfiguration. And it's detailed or it's talked about in multiple gospel accounts. And maybe you've heard it before, maybe you've read it or heard it preached. But here's what's kind of taking place, because there's a lot of different pieces to this that are important to grasp and to make sense of. This story comes on the heels of Jesus and his disciples being in Caesarea Philippi. And Caesarea Philippi was a place of pagan worship. And I talked a little bit about this in the final week of our Kingdom Come series, about how it was there that Jesus asked the disciples, who do people say that I am? And they said, some say Elijah, some say another prophet, you know, John the Baptist revitalized. And he says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter, receiving this word of knowledge from God, says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, the Messiah. And so they're there at this moment. And as I shared, Caesarea Philippi was located in the northern part of Israel at the base of Mount Hermon. And the furthest, just about as far north in Israel as you can go. And so right on the heels of this, Jesus takes his disciples to Caesarea Philippi. And then right after, he takes them to this place and he climbs this mountain. And most scholars believe, because of its proximity and where it was located, that Jesus took Peter, James, and John, and he climbed up Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon has a lot of significance. Now, to get this, you have to kind of understand a little bit about like the allegory and the meaning of the geography, or the role that geography plays in understanding scripture and the way that we see things. So both historically and religiously speaking, Israelites practiced or had this belief that, you know, there's this kind of common theme throughout the Old Testament and New Testament about ascending and descending, about highs and lows. And kind of the general rule of thumb is that as you go higher, the closer you are to God, right? So the further north you are is another description of that. And then the further south you are, you're further away from God, or the lower you descend, the further you are from God. And they use that kind of as allegory or metaphor to help convey this depiction of drawing close to God. Now, Mount Hermon is the tallest point in all of Israel. And it also is located in the furthest, the furthest northern point of Israel is located at the top of Mount Hermon. And so you have this duality here that it's not only geographically located in the north, so you're moving higher to get there, but it's also physically the highest elevation that you can get to in all of Israel. So it is the highest of the highest. In other words, it is the holiest of the holiest, this figurative representation that is the holiest place you can be, the closest to God. To the contrary, the Dead Sea, for instance, is located in the south of Israel. And if you go there, you find it to be very barren, very dry, very much like a desert. And so the idea there is that as you move toward Mount Hermon, Israel gets fruitful, there's a lot of farming, a lot of vegetation, and then you ascend Mount Hermon, you're getting closer to God, but as you move away from the holiest place, you move south toward the Dead Sea, below sea level, it's dry, it's barren, and it's desert. So this is a depiction, a metaphor, if you will, for what Jesus is doing with the disciples. He takes them to the holiest place, and there atop this mountain, he's transformed. Now, side note, the word transformed that is used here is the Greek word meta. It's where we get our name. In fact, this word is only used four times in the New Testament, twice to describe the transfiguration, Jesus' transformation, and then once in Romans chapter 12 and another time in 1 Corinthians. And both, in all four of these instances, it means to be transformed. It's where we get our name. It's why we say we want every person to experience the transformative power of Jesus. We were meta before meta became meta, or before Facebook became meta. Like we're actually about the real meta, not like, you know, some AI or artificial world, the metaverse or whatever they want to call it. Like we are the legit meta, and they can say what they want, but we know the truth. Because we base it off of this very thing, that Jesus was transformed, and that's what he desires for us. And as he's transformed, he's met by two pretty significant people, and two people who actually were dead, Moses and Elijah. And his disciples, they see this, and they see what's happening there. And now maybe you're like me, and you're like, well, what is Moses and Elijah? Like, why did they show up? Why those two guys to be there in this moment? And that's a good question. But the answer is pretty simple. It's not obvious, but it's simple. And it's simply this, that Jesus said in Matthew 5:17, he didn't come to abolish the law, but he came to fulfill the law and the prophets. So what he was doing there and why those two appeared is that Moses represented the law, and Elijah represented the prophets. And so their appearance with Jesus was a way of saying to his disciples, a way of showing them that I am the fulfillment of this, that I am more than just the law, that I am more than just the prophets. I am the fulfillment of both of these things. So Peter recognized this and he gets excited. He says, well, maybe we should build some shelters. We should build some booths. And this is kind of where we get the timeline, because this is just prior to the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, which is, to this day, an annual celebration in the Jewish tradition, in the Jewish faith. But it was a feast of harvest that usually happens between the first and the second week of October on our calendar year. And so Peter, knowing that this is coming up, says, God, this is amazing. Jesus, this is amazing. What if we build some booths, some shelters to celebrate? Because part of the tradition was that as people made their way to Jerusalem, it was a feast of the harvest, they would be so packed in the city that they would have to build these shelters, these booths, if you will, to provide temporary housing. And as well, if you were farming and it was the time of harvest, you'd be out in the field, so you'd build temporary housing so you could collect your, you know, what you were, you know, or your harvest or whatever is what I'm trying to say. So the short part of it is that Peter's like, wow, this is exciting. We should build something here to commemorate, to celebrate what just happened. And then God chimes in and God's like, hey, it kind of scares them and shocks them. And he says, this is my son with whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him. I kind of read this as God saying, hey, he's God. He's Jesus. Now shut up and pay attention. And I think that translation is actually found like in the New Ricky version. Like that's the way I envision God speaking this moment. And they're scared. And Jesus kind of comes and like, he's like, hey guys, like it's okay. You can get up. My dad, yeah, he gets a little irritable sometimes, but it's okay. You can stand up, right? Like you can stand up and see what's happened. And I love what Jesus says. He says, don't tell anyone about this until the resurrection, until several months down the road. But one part in particular really stands out to me, and that's at the end of verse 8. Notice what it says. It says, Moses and Elijah were gone, and it says, and they saw only Jesus. They saw only Jesus. See, Jesus' whole goal with this mountaintop experience was to get his disciples to see him differently. He wanted them to know that he wasn't the same as Moses and Elijah, that he wasn't just the fulfillment of the law or just, another prophet. He wanted them to know that in the holiest of places, they would have an encounter with God. He wasn't just another rabbi or just another teacher. He wasn't just a good person who did good things to help others. He wasn't just a miracle worker or someone who could prophesy about what was going to happen in the future. He wanted them to know and to see him differently. He wanted them to see him as God. And that is the entire message of the Easter story. That is the big idea with the Easter story. And I believe this is where the Easter message begins. You see, the Easter story begins with an invitation to see Jesus differently. The Easter story begins with an invitation to see Jesus differently. Jesus wants us, you and I, to see him as God. He's not just another prophet. He's not just another teacher. He's not just someone who did good things for good people. He's not just someone who said nice things or gave us a way, an ethic to live by or to abide by. He is inviting you and I, he is inviting us to see him as God. And that was the invitation that began the Easter story. And you know, this time of year, we talk a lot about inviting people to Easter, you know, churches across the board. And really what we're saying and really what we mean by that is that we're inviting people to see Jesus differently. Because we know like Easter is that time where we're going to talk about Jesus. Like that's it. Like we're not talking about money and giving to the church. We're not talking about serving and helping people in need or giving up like your valuables or your belongings. We're not talking about marriage and relationships. We're not talking about like all these other things where like if you were to invite someone to come, you'd be like, oh, I don't know if it's going to like be relevant or like speak to where they're at in life. Easter, we're inviting people to see Jesus differently. And when we make the emphasis about seeing Jesus differently, and when we make the emphasis about seeing Jesus, it has the potential to be so, so powerful. And here's what I mean by that. Have you ever noticed that people who have something against Christianity very rarely have something against Christ? Like, have you ever noticed that? The people who have something against Christianity very rarely have something against Christ. You know, they may have something, some issue with Christians, like something that a Christian did, or a way a Christian treated them, or a way, you know, or something that a Christian said to them, or maybe something that a Christian says on Twitter, or like on CNN, or on Fox News, or at a protest, or whatever it might be. Like they have an issue with that. Or maybe they have an issue with the church and the way the church historically or the way the church denominationally has handled situations, and they're upset and disgusted with the way scandals of abuse, these horrific and terrible and vile acts have been covered up or protected, or the people involved in those acts have been protected. or maybe they're tired of seeing, you know, a well-known figures in the church and kind of embroiled in scandal and moral failures. Or maybe they can't stand the fact that when it comes to matters of justice and racial equality and standing up for the oppressed or the marginalized, that the church has either been silent or absent in these things, if not actually against these things. And so they have an issue there. And even for those, you know, in recent years, those who were once a part of the church, once who would have identified as Christian and have now like kind of embraced and appropriated this term or this title of deconstruction, and they've deconstructed from this way. You know, what you'll find even with most of people who would identify in that category, they've not deconstructed or have had an issue with Christ. You know, no, don't get me wrong. There are people who feel like they have a legitimate issue with Christ. You know, maybe God didn't come through for them at a time of need or an illness and someone they love passed away or something like that. So I'm not minimizing or saying that doesn't exist. But what you'll find is that there are actually very few people who are anti-Jesus. Yes, they have an issue with the people of Jesus. Yes, they have an issue with the organization that represents Jesus. But very rarely will you find someone who is anti-Jesus or anti-Christ. I think actually that people are far more interested and curious and willing to engage and respond to the person of Jesus than they are if you talk about faith or the church. If you talk about Jesus and you speak to Jesus, they're curious because Jesus has this aura about him. I mean, number one, he's God, so that kind of helps. But number two, he has this intrigue, this curiosity that kind of compels people to want to entertain or consider, is he really who he says he is? Is he the person that I think he is? And this is so significant because I guess the beauty in it is that Jesus invites all people to see him that way, to see him differently. And there's this intrigue surrounding it where people are willing to engage there. And again, they very rarely have an issue with Jesus. And so they're willing to start there. And I think that's the power in all of this, is that he wants us to see him differently. He's inviting us to see him differently. He wants us to see that he's different from what we've heard. He wants us to know and to experience firsthand how he's different from what someone else might have communicated or what someone else might have demonstrated or how other Christians or other churches might have acted about him or concerning him. And he wants us to know that he's different from what we might even expect of him or from him. This is the invitation that Jesus makes. And I believe this invitation is so powerful for two reasons. The first reason is simply this. Because Jesus invites you to see him differently no matter who you are. No matter who you are, Jesus doesn't care your racial background. He doesn't care your ethnic background. He doesn't care your belief system, your faith system, your lack thereof. He doesn't care about your financial status, your wealth. He invites you to see him no matter who you are. And I think about, like, you know, his disciples and these three guys in particular that went up to this mountaintop with Jesus. Peter, James, and John. I don't know what you know about them, but they're pretty simple and straightforward. They were fishermen. They were tradesmen. Now, apart from what you think or apart from what you might glean from scriptures about that, what you need to know is that like fishermen and tradesmen were relatively normal people. You see, in the Hebrew culture and the Hebrew tradition, from the ages of 5 to 10 was kind of like the basic fundamental education that every child received, boys and girls alike. And then at age 10, boys had the opportunity to go beyond that and to study for another couple years under a rabbi, under a synagogue teacher. It was kind of like age 5 to 10 was general education about the Torah, the first five books of our Old Testament, but the five books of the Hebrew law. So they would study this, they would memorize it, they would learn it, and they would ultimately seek to apply. But for ages 10 to about 13, there was kind of a deepening of that application or a deepening of that understanding. And then from 13 to 15, if kids continued on, if boys continued on through that program, they would learn how to apply and interpret the law to everyday life. And if they showed aptitude beyond that, then they would have the opportunity to study underneath a rabbi, specifically under the tutelage of a rabbi, where they could grow and eventually become a teacher of the law themselves. But only the cream of the crop, only the best of the best were selected and given access or opportunity to become that. In fact, for most people, they would stop, their education in the law would stop somewhere between the ages of 10 and 13. And that's where that boy would grow and move on to, you know, some sort of trade based on what their family was doing or based on what benefited them financially, economically, in the economy or the geography or the region in which they lived. And so what we can understand or glean about these guys who were fishermen is that at some point, 13, 10 years old, maybe 15 even, they abandoned a formal education process, or less so abandoned, and more likely that they weren't selected for this continuation of education, and they embraced a trade or a skill. Now, that doesn't mean they were dumb. It doesn't mean they were stupid. It doesn't mean that they were lazy. They were hard workers, good people, but they were normal people. In other words, these aren't like your Ivy League graduates. These aren't Harvard-type guys. These aren't the cream of the crop in society or in the Hebrew tradition. They were, in other words, just nothing spectacular out of the ordinary. They were normal people who had normal jobs, living normal lives. And why this matters and why I find this to be so compelling and so profound is that because this is who Jesus selected to be with him. This is who Jesus invited to be with him. You see, Jesus wasn't concerned about selecting the cream of the crop, the brainiest of the brainiest, the smartest or the best religious pedigree. He wanted and he chose normal people. He said, no matter who you are, you can be a fisherman. You can be a normal person. And I want to invite you to see me differently. I want to invite you to know me differently. And I think this is so good because, listen, there's so many of us who maybe feel like we're not smart enough. You know, like I know for me, like I'm smart and I'm skilled and I have a high level of confidence. But at the same time, I know like I'm not Steve Jobs. I'm not Anthony Fauci. I'm not Elon Musk. You know, I'm not Jeff Bezos. Like I don't have like this brainiac idea or ability to, you know, take in information and analyze it and produce something that seemingly has the potential to change the world. Like I don't. And we struggle like not feeling smart enough. Like, well, what? Like, you know what? I don't know all the verses in this book. And like, I mean, I just don't know. Like, I'm not like, I don't know everything about God. So why would he choose me or why would he invite me? Like, I don't know the verses. Like, I mean, to be honest, like there's some stuff that I believe or some stuff that I think, but I don't even know if it's in the Bible. Like someone said it and it sounds like it would be in the Bible, but I don't know if it's in the Bible. And so I'm not smart enough. Then there's others who feel like maybe you're not good enough. Like you're not like this super uber Christian. Like, yeah, you try to follow God, but you don't get it right. You're not always as dedicated as you want to be or as you desire to be. You still struggle. You have some vices or some issues that you find yourself frustrated with. And yet you're like, I'm not good enough to be one of his disciples. I'm not good enough. Like I wouldn't have been invited into that inner circle with Jesus. I wouldn't have been given that privilege or that opportunity. And then there's another group or another segment of our church or our listeners who feel like maybe you're not worthy. You're just not worthy because of your past or because of your present. You struggle with anxiety or depression or shame or guilt or whatever it might be. And you feel like, you know, like I'm just like, I mean, certainly there's someone who's much better than me. Certainly Jesus could pick and choose someone who's going to do a better job than me. And yet that's not what he did. To the one who doesn't feel smart enough, he equips you and he empowers you through the Holy Spirit. To the one who feels not good enough, Jesus restores you. He says, I don't care how far you've fallen. I don't care how far gone you've been. I will restore you and I will elevate you and I will bring you back to this place. And to the one who feels not worthy, Jesus has made you whole and Jesus has called you. And he says, I'm inviting you into this. I'm inviting you to see me differently. I don't care who you are. Jesus invites you. But he doesn't just invite you no matter who you are. He invites you to see him differently no matter where you are. No matter where you are on your journey, beginning or end, in the middle, somewhere lost, directionally out of sorts, running away. Jesus invites you to see him differently no matter where you are on this faith journey. And what I love about this is that when you look at the lives of the disciples and the people that we know as the original followers of Jesus, their lives were totally across the spectrum. I mean, you take Peter, for instance, who's known for his boldness and his audacity, right? Hey, God, let me help you over here. Let me build some, you know, some shelters or whatever, some booths. And he has this boldness and this audacity always kind of going out. But Peter also had this like weird kind of flinching ability to like, or kind of like flipping ability to get angry. Like if you remember in the Garden of Gethsemane when they approached Jesus, Peter responds, he pulls out a sword out of a sheath and he swings it at a guy, nearly decapitates him, cuts off his ear, nearly cuts off his head. Like, just like that, like out of anger and out of rage. And yet, he was invited to see Jesus differently. Think about James and John, who, you know, let's just put it this way, maybe saw themselves in a better light than others did. Had a sense of ego or a sense of like pride and being proud about who they were, to the point where they went to Jesus, to the degree where they just kind of unapologetically went to Jesus, say, hey, Jesus, when you die, Jesus tells me he's going to be crucified, this deeply emotional thing, I'm going to be betrayed, arrested, all this stuff. Hey Jesus, thanks for telling us that. By the way, when you get to heaven, can you save the seat on the right and the seat on the left for me and my brother so we can sit next to you? Like, they just viewed themselves as being so much better than everyone else that certainly Jesus would accept their request and just elevate them above everyone else. So they're just a tinge of pride and seeing themselves differently. Yet others in the group, like Matthew, right, who was a tax collector, like in ancient Israel, you had like sinners and then you had a different category, tax collectors, because they sold themselves out. They betrayed their own people to work for the Roman government, and they would charge taxes higher than what was actually being required by Rome. And they would skim off the top and keep it for themselves, and they would get rich off of the betrayal of their own people. And yet, Jesus invited him to see him differently. Someone who was manipulative, someone who was a liar, someone who was a deceiver, was a part of Jesus' little kind of ragtag group, his rat pack, if you will. Yet others that we know less about, who are maybe more quiet or on the peripheral, and so they're not like, at least from what we can tell, they weren't these like uber audacious, loudmouth Christians, loudmouth followers of Jesus who just at every turn told people about Christ, at every turn were witnessing and sharing their faith. And then you had some like Judas, who was called the zealot, a political zealot, someone who wanted to overthrow the Roman government. And some, you know, if he lived in today's world, he'd fit right in with the far right, and he'd fit right in with Antifa, depending on his political affiliation. He wasn't in the middle. He was either extremely right wing or extremely left wing, wherever you want to place him, but he was way out at the extremities. And ultimately would be the kind of guy that when Jesus didn't do what he wanted, would sell out his best friends for 30 pieces of silver so that ultimately Jesus could be crucified. And of course, you had someone like Thomas, who walked with Jesus, lived with Jesus, but after the resurrection couldn't believe what happened and was still kind of like overcome by moments of doubt. Like, he wasn't the kind of guy that just had faith 100% of the time. And so when you look at this spectrum and the scope of who these people were and where they were, and yet Jesus says, hey, I'm inviting you to see me differently. And the same is true for you and I, that maybe you feel like I'm just learning, I'm just figuring out this Jesus thing, I'm just kind of deepening it and making it personal for me, and I'm new at this thing, and Jesus is like, hey, that's all right, come in. I want you to see me differently. Maybe you feel like you're completely sold out. You're like, I love Jesus, I love God, I'm all in, I'm going to follow this thing with everything that I have. I believe and I have confidence in Jesus. And then Jesus is like, hey, I want you to see me differently. Maybe you feel like you're just too messed up. You've done some things in the past. Maybe it's not even in the past. Maybe there's some things that are happening right now in your life that you feel ashamed of. Some things that you aren't too proud of. And it's maybe, it doesn't, to others, it may not be a big deal, but to you, as you follow Jesus, you're like, I probably shouldn't be involved in this stuff. I probably shouldn't be doing this. Or maybe it is something significant and you're afraid that if other people found out about what I was doing, if other people found out about how I was living my life, like, they would disown me. They would kind of, you know, push away from me because this is not who I'm supposed to be. This is not how I'm supposed to live my life. And you feel too messy and messed up. And just like, hey, come here. I want you to see me differently. Or you feel like broken and your life's a mess. And like, I just have all these pieces, anxiety, depression, emotional stress, overwhelmed. Like, I'm just so frail. And she's like, bring the pieces to me. I want you to see me differently. This is who Jesus is. This is the invitation that he offers. And this, he's inviting all of us. He's extending this invitation to all of us, no matter who we are, no matter where we are, to see him differently. And this invitation is open to all, and it's open to everyone. But there's another side of this, another side to this truth, that the reality is that not everyone takes Jesus up on this offer. Not everyone accepts this invitation. And I want you to go back to Matthew 17, verse 1. And notice what it says. It says, 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain. Notice this last phrase. To be alone. To be alone. There were just three of the disciples with Jesus. Not 12. I don't know if the other nine were invited but had other plans. I don't know if the other nine weren't invited and Jesus just deemed that, you know, Peter, James, and John were the three he wanted to take with him. I'm not entirely sure why there were only three. But several years ago, I was reading this passage, and a revelation dawned on me. And I wrote it down actually in the margin of this Bible. I was studying through this passage, and I just simply wrote that on the mountaintop with Jesus are very few people. On the mountaintop with Jesus are very few people. That everyone is invited, but not everyone accepts the invitation. And it reminds me of a situation that I had a few years back. I rented a cabin up in the mountains of Vermont, and I was kind of just there for the weekend on my own doing like a personal spiritual retreat. And I decided that I wanted to do some hikes while I was there and take some time hiking. So I chose this one hike, which for the record is labeled very hard on the All Trails hiking app. And I selected this hike and planned to do it. And the hike was to climb Equinox Mountain, which is the third highest mountain in all of Vermont. And it sits at an elevation just under 3,900 feet. I think it's like 3,882 feet above sea level. And so the hike is about 3.2 miles. And you're climbing from the base of the mountain and hiking to the top of the mountain. And you're ascending over 3,000 feet over the course of this 3 miles. In other words, you're going about 1,000 feet a mile. Like, it's basically like climbing stairs the whole way. And it's brutal, like it's grueling. And so I set out on this hike, and it took me, I can't remember, I wanna say, I know it was over 90 minutes and under 2 hours. So let's just call it, you know, like an hour and 40 minutes, hour 45 or whatever. It took a while. And I make my way up to the top. I get to the top of this hike, and I should say, as I climbed this trail, as I hiked this trail, there were other people on the trail, but it wasn't one of those trails that you go to on a nice Saturday, and it's packed with a bunch of people. It wasn't. It was relatively quiet. It was, you know, you're kind of, you're seeing other people on the trail, but it's not packed with people. So you're on this hike. You make it. I get up to the top, and you know what happened? I got to the top, and when I got to the top, I looked around and was kind of shocked because there was a whole bunch of people up there. Like way more people than I saw on the trail. And these people were people who, some of whom like didn't look like the hiking type. And certainly they were wearing like jeans and like regular shoes and like sunglasses. Like they didn't hike. And as I kind of made my way like through, like I saw like there was a parking lot and I didn't realize you could drive to the top of the mountain. You could drive. So I was a bit bummed. I was like, wait, I just hiked. Like my legs are on fire. They're burning. And I could have just driven here. Like I parked at the bottom of the mountain. I drove to the bottom of the mountain, not the top. And I will say, like, the view was epic. In fact, I've got a picture. Like, here's a view from the top of Equinox Mountain facing east. And you can see parts of New Hampshire. You can see toward Massachusetts. I mean, just a beautiful day. And you know what I realized, what occurred to me as I was up there? Is that everyone saw the same thing. Everyone who was up there saw the same thing, but I saw it differently. You see, in fact, I started to kind of watch and look around. And what I noticed was that the people who drove to the top kind of had a similar trend or a similar pattern. They would come up to the top, they would walk around, they would look, they would take a couple photos, and then they would basically leave after like 20, maybe 30 minutes. Some of them packed a lunch, so they stayed up there to eat. But by and large, they were gone relatively quick. Whereas those of us who hiked, you know, 90 minutes, those of us who hiked 2 hours to get to the top, we laid in the grass, we stayed put, we sat down, we soaked it in, we looked, we would sit in one place for 20 or 30 minutes, then move to the other side of the mountain and look in the other direction for another 20 or 30 minutes. And we just kind of took our time to soak it all in. You see, everyone saw the same thing, but not everyone saw it the same way. Those of us who hiked to the top of the mountain saw it differently than those who took the shortcut, those who took the easy route. And in the same way, everyone can participate in an Easter service and everyone can participate in an Easter celebration and say, yes, Jesus is King. He is risen. He is Lord. But only those who incorporate the Easter story into their everyday lives are able to see Jesus differently. Only those who are willing to climb this mountain, to accept the invite to climb this mountain, to go where Jesus goes, to walk where Jesus walks, to see as Jesus sees, only those who accept that invitation in their everyday lives will see Jesus differently. And fortunately for us, this is the invitation that Jesus is extending to you and to I, to climb the mountain with him. To see a new or a different version of him and to experience him in our lives differently tomorrow than we did today. This is the invitation of the Easter story. This is where the Easter story begins, to see Jesus differently. The question is, will you accept his invitation and step with him and climb that mountain?
Thanks again for joining us today on the MetaChurch podcast. To connect further with us, find us on Instagram or visit us online.